I want you to open to Judges chapter number 19 today as we continue to look at the appended material at the end of the book of Judges. We're going to eventually get back to the front end of the book of Judges, which is chronological. But this material, for whatever reason, has been put at the end of the book, but it seems to belong very early on in the chronology. And we know that because of, for example, the last time we were talking about the grandson of Moses being involved in one of the stories. So that had to have been very early on. This next story, chapter number 19, is where it begins, is going to involve the high priest Phinehas. And he's the third high priest of the Israeli nation, the second inside the promised land. And so that means it has to come very early on in the story of the promised land. So with that background, let's look at verse 1 of chapter 19. In those days when there was no king in Israel, and you remember the rest of that comment that the writer of the book of Judges keeps inserting here, and everybody did as they felt like. That's not a good thing. When everybody's flying by the seat of their pants, when everybody is making up their own rules, that is going to lead to chaos. And that is especially true when the king that they don't have is he who is. God himself is not being honored and submitted to by the people in these stories living inside the promised land. And it's very frustrating, I am sure, to him. So in those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite. So we've got another story involving a Levite. Remember, the last story involved the Levite grandson of Moses, who became the pet priest of a guy in Ephraim. Well, guess what? This story also has a Levite connected to the country of Ephraim. A certain Levite who was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. Now, sojourning there means that he is likely in one of the Levitical towns. He is not an Ephraimite. He is a Levite. But the Levites were intentionally scattered by God into various cities spread out over all of the tribal areas so that they could have taught the law and judged people according to the law. But as we find out, they are also flying by the seat of their pants and not representing God properly, because he took himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now, a concubine is a secondary wife, which was not supposed to be happening. That was not part of God's original plan. It was supposed to be one man, one woman together for a lifetime. There were some, and I'm going to put air quotes around this, legitimate, times that concubines were taken, such as what you saw in the story of Sarah and Abraham, where Sarah could not have a child, and so they invoked, she specifically, invoked a Mesopotamian law that allowed a concubine to be taken by the husband so that the concubine could provide surrogacy to the wife. There needed to be a legal arrangement. And so she provided a baby for the couple. But because of the intimacy of this surrogacy arrangement, she had to be married to the man. So that's one of those, quote, legitimate, end quote, reasons for surrogacy or for concubinage. But typically, concubines were taken by people that were powerful just because they could, or to make deals with the family of that concubine, which appears to be the case here. As we will see, the Levite seems to be more attached to his father-in-law than he is to his concubine. So his concubine, verse 2 in this story, was unfaithful to him. Now, from time to time, I critique the way our English Bibles translations have treated the language, the original language. This gives the impression that she cheated on him. The more possible one is that she just left. She didn't feel connected to him, so she went home to dad, is effectively what this story is saying. His concubine was not attached to him, so she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. So she goes back home to her father's house. And 4 months later, when it becomes obvious she's not coming back, verse 3, her husband arose and went after her, now listen to this, to speak kindly to her and bring her back. So he went there with the intention of trying to convince her to come back to this place in Ephraim, where they were supposed to have some sort of legal arrangement. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys, transport. She brought him into her father's house. So obviously, he meets her first. She brings him back in to meet with dad again, because there would have been arrangements earlier, because in the customs of the time period and the region, he would have already met with the father of her to make arrangements for the bridal price and to ask for permission to marry her, all of those sorts of things. So they've already had some sort of dealings. So now she brings him back in to re-meet with her father. His father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay. Wait a second. I skipped one line here, very important at the end of verse number 3. When the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. So that tells you dad, who's had daughter home for 4 months, is happy that the guy he married her off to has shown up finally to bring her back into the marriage, back into the relationship. He's also happy to reacquaint himself with him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay. He remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. And then on the 4th day, they arose early in the morning. He prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. So evidently, whatever had messed with the relationship has now been resolved. The woman was planning on going back to Ephraim territory with her Levite husband. After being there for 3 days. And on this 4th day, the day that should have been for departure, the father-in-law said, just stick around a little bit longer. Spend a little bit more today, then you can head out. So the two of them, notice it's focused on the relationship between the Levite and his father-in-law. The relationship between Levite and the woman is not what drives this story. So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. The girl's father said to the man, please spend the night. Let your heart be merry. And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. And then on the 5th day, he arose early in the morning to depart. The girl's father said, ah, strengthen your heart. Wait until the day declines. You know, wait until after, you know, noon. Wait until after it's closer to the afternoon. So they ate, both of them. And then when the man and his concubine and his servant rose to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, ah, behold, the day has waned toward evening, which tells me it's after mid-afternoon. You know, that place where the sun is 45-degree angle to the west horizon. It is going down. There's 3 to 4 hours of sunlight left. That's about it. And so, please spend the night. Behold, the day draws into its close. Lodge here. Let your heart be merry. And tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and then go home. So, come on, one more night. But the man would not spend the night. He just feels, I got to head back home again. So he rose up, departed. Now, this is at Bethlehem, remember. So they leave Bethlehem at some point. I'm going to use the typical way of thinking about this. In a 12-hour daylight, 12-hour nighttime arrangement, 3 o'clock is the midpoint in the afternoon. So at some point after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they leave. They arrived opposite Jebus. That is Jerusalem. Now, at this time, Jerusalem was known by the name Jebus because the Jebusites lived there. And it's a little oval hill that is surrounded by walls that's about 5 miles north of Bethlehem. So it's on the road north toward Ephraim. 5 miles from Bethlehem means that they would have been there about an hour or so before the sun goes down. He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, so sunset is coming. And the servant said to his master, come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. And his master said to him, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners. Because at this time in Israeli history, which is very early in the period, after Joshua had destroyed the city of Jerusalem, it got rebuilt and reoccupied by Canaanites. There are no Israelis living here. The city is inside the boundaries of Benjamin. But the Benjamites have not made it their own yet. So it's a foreign city inside Israeli territory. And he says, I'm not going to spend the night with a bunch of Canaanites who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah. Now, Gibeah is a couple of more miles to the north of Jerusalem. So they can make it there probably before the sun hits the horizon on this day. And it belongs to Benjamin, and so it has Israelis living in it. So he said to his young man, that's his servant, come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night either at Gibeah or at Ramah. Ramah is a couple more miles beyond Gibeah. And so even though the sun probably would have set after they hit Gibeah and kept going, it would still be light enough that they could have made it to Ramah before it becomes full dark. So that's the plan. So they passed on. They went their way. The sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. So this, because of the way they're traveling, apparently, sunset hits as they approach Gibeah. So they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took him into his house to spend the night. Now, the way the walled cities worked, was very often the main gate in particular into the city, had a big plaza in front of it. If it was a double gated city, there'd be the main gate from the exterior into a plaza area, and then there was another gated area into the main part of the city. So the square that we're talking about here is actually the trade area. It's where people set up the open market. It's also where the legal people, the leaders of the city meet to help with transactions. When it talks about sitting in the gate, it's talking about being near this plaza, near this square. So the day has come to an end. The gate of the city is getting ready to be closed for security reasons. And the people who have been selling things are heading home. They're not going to be in this open area any longer. So it's starting to be more deserted. So these guys are kind of settling in there to basically camp. Behold, verse 16, an old man was... Now, when it uses the term old man here, understand that in the culture of the day, especially Israeli culture, when you hit your 50th birthday, you were considered old, an elder member of society. So he is probably still quite capable of doing hard labor. Don't get the impression he is frail. So an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. So sun's gone down, so he's coming back to spend the night in the city. Now, this man, was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. So he's actually an Ephraimite, but he's living in Gibeah of Benjamin for whatever reason. And he's apparently been there a fairly long period of time, so he's kind of been accepted by the locals as one of their own. So the men of the place were Benjamites. He lifted up his eyes and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. So he sees somebody he's never seen before kind of hanging out in the square. The old man said, "Where are you going? Where'd he come from?" He said, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remotest parts of the hill country of Ephraim from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of he who is, but no one has taken me into his house." Now, there is a note that should be taken in consideration here, and I prefer the Septuagint, as most of you know by now if you've been my students for any period of time. I prefer the Greek Septuagint's writing more often than not when there's a dispute between it and the Masoretic text. The Septuagint here does not say the house of he who is. It says my home. And that makes much more contextual sense. So I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I'm going back to my home in Ephraim. But no one took me into his home, so nobody's practiced hospitality. However, verse 19, we have straw and feed for our donkeys, bread and wine for me, your female servant, the young man with your servants. There's no lack of anything. But the old man said, "Oh, shalom lachem, peace be to you. I'll care for all your wants." So he kind of feels a kindred spirit with a fellow Ephraimite and says, "I'll give you some hospitality." And then he says something that should not be missed. He says, "Only do not spend the night in the square." Now that sounds a little ominous. It sounds like this plaza, when it becomes full dark, is a dangerous place. It's not a nice neighborhood. And remember, this is a bad time in Israeli history. Everybody's doing what they feel like. And that's not always a good thing. So he's basically warning him, it's not safe out here. Come stay at my house. So he brought him into his house, and he gave the donkeys feed, and then he washed their feet and ate and drank. So typical hospitality. You bring them to your house, you take care of their animals, you wash their feet, probably have the sandals going to be taken care of as well, give them something to eat with the promises of a place to sleep. Now, as they were making their hearts merry, and I want you to understand that the focus at this point in the story is going to be on the Levite from Ephraim and the Ephraim living in Gibeah. Behold, the men of the city, sons of Belial, which is an idiom meaning exactly what we have in our English Standard Text, worthless fellows, bad guys, sinners of a horrible sort. They surrounded the house, beating on the door. Now, it doesn't say it in the text, but I would imagine that they've probably already been drinking and are just sinners on many, many different levels at the same time here. They said to the old man, the master of the house, "Bring out the men who came into your house that we may know him." Now, the "know him" here is most definitely a euphemism for sexual activity. This story sounds all the world like the story of Lot and the two angels that came to his house on the evening before God struck the city down for it being such a place of sinfulness. And I think one of the reasons that the wording takes this form in the book of Judges is to parallel between that story and this story. Because in this time period, many of the Israelites have gone down the Canaanite route in morality, and they've descended into great sin. And so we see the same thing happen here that happened in Sodom. The master of the house, he went out to them, said to them, "No, my brothers, don't act so wickedly since this man has come into my house. Don't do this vile thing." So this is a sin beyond acceptability in their own twisted minds. The homosexual rape is what is being described here. And then he does something that happened in the Sodom story as well that is beyond our belief sometimes that anybody could say something like this. This guy says, "Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now, violate them," or humiliate them, basically have sex with them, "and do with them what seems good to you." That echoes exactly what we've been reading about this time period. There was no king in Israel in those days, and everyone did as they saw good in their own heart. And so this guy is saying, you go ahead and do your thing, but you do your thing with these two females, which tells you that they don't value these women as highly as they value themselves. And that's horrendously wrong and sinful. "But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing." But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine. This is the Ephraimite man who is passing through. He grabbed his recently restored concubine and basically threw her out of the house, made her go out to them. And so they knew her, and they abused her all night until the morning. A horrendous story. As the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as the morning appeared, the woman came. She fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was. And the word master here should be understood in the sense of husband. in the ancient wording of Hebrew, Adoni, or Adon, was also the word for husband. So where her husband was until it was light. So she basically battered and violated, falls down, dying at the doorway. Her husband rose up in the morning. When he opened the door of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's be going." But there was no answer. And the reason there's no answer is she's dead. And it's his fault. Let's make no bones about this. It's his fault. So he put her on the donkey, put her corpse basically on the donkey. The man rose up and he went away to his home. Probably another day's travel. Day and a half, maybe two. When he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces. So probably cutting off her hands and her feet and her lower arms and her upper arms and her lower legs and her upper legs and her head and cutting up her torso in maybe a couple of pieces. And so he takes these bloody pieces and sends them by messenger throughout all the territory of Israel. Why did he do this? Because he is angry that this woman that he supposedly cared about in a very twisted way, we'll have to acknowledge, is dead, and he wants something done about it. And so all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak." We'll get the rest of the story in next time we're into the Word.